So our passage this morning, as I said, is 1 Kings chapter 18, verses 17 to 39. And I guess that if you were all unacquainted with the scriptures, then I could take an approach to this passage that went something like this. I could read the first few verses of the passage and then talk about them, and then read the next few verses of the passage and talk about those, and then the next few, and so on. And I could build up the tension and the suspense as we go along, and eventually we would reach verse 38, and it would be ever so dramatic, and a wave of excitement would pass through the room at the thought of fire suddenly coming down from heaven. But of course, most of you are fairly well acquainted, I should imagine, with the scriptures, and that approach is not going to work. You know this story. You remember the pictures, perhaps, that accompanied this story in your children's Bibles all those years ago. You don't need me to tell you that fire came down from heaven. What you might need me to tell you, however, is why it did. Not because I'm cleverer than you or have some special insight that you don't have, but simply because you may never have given much thought to that particular point. You've never really asked the question, perhaps, why? Why did Yahweh send fire from heaven on this occasion? And so that's the question I would like us to consider this morning. And I want to suggest to you four reasons why he sent fire from heaven. And so reason number one, to vindicate his servant. To vindicate his servant. So in praying then for fire to come down, one of Elijah's petitions, you'll notice, is this, verse 36, let it be known this day that I am your servant. And presumably then when Yahweh immediately responds to the prayer and sends fire from heaven, one of the things he's doing is just that. He's letting it be known that day that Elijah is his servant, or to put it another way, he's vindicating his servant Elijah. Now, you might ask, who would ever doubt that Elijah is Yahweh's servant? I mean, from those days with our children's Bibles that I mentioned a moment ago, we have all regarded Elijah as this unambiguous, out-and-out hero who we might think is ever going to regard Elijah as anything else, as anything but a hero, a servant in the service of the living God. Well, Ahab, the king of Israel at this time, He may have regarded Elijah a little differently. Notice how he speaks to him at the very start of our passage there in verse 17. When Ahab saw Elijah, Ahab said to him, "Is it you, you troubler of Israel?" And to get the full effect of that rather terse greeting, I think we need to appreciate that that word troubler has a history. It's been used before in connection with an Israelite, a very infamous Israelite. I'm thinking of Achan. You remember Achan? The man who secretly kept for himself some of Jericho's treasures that should have been destroyed. And because he did that, you remember, Israel languished under a divine curse. They were no longer victorious on the battlefield until that sin had been uncovered and the guilty man had been stoned to death. And in Joshua 7, verse 25, then Joshua refers to that man Achan in the same language we have here as a troubler, a man who brought trouble on Israel. And here in verse 17 of our passage then, Ahab may well intend a deliberate allusion to that, a deliberate echo of that earlier episode in Israel's history. He may well be suggesting that Elijah is another Achan, another rebel, another cancer within Israel that needs to be surgically removed so that the curse, this time taking the form of a drought rather than military defeat, will be lifted from the nation. That's probably why, according to verse 10, which of course lay outside our reading this morning, that Ahab has launched an international search for Elijah. It isn't because he wants a summit with the prophets where they'll sit together around a table and talk about why this drought has come on the land and how they should resolve this crisis. No, it's because he probably wants to kill Elijah. He wants to deal with Elijah the same way that Joshua had dealt with Achan. And against that backdrop then, surely we begin to understand Elijah's prayer here. Let it be known this day that I am your servant. In other words, let it be known that I'm not what Ahab is making me out to be. I'm not the figure that the reports are suggesting that I am. I'm not Achan in some new guise. I'm not a renegade. I'm not a rotten apple incurring disaster on the nation. Let those misrepresentations be blasted away, Lord, and let me be vindicated today as your loyal servant, Yahweh. And you know, the vindication then of his servant that Yahweh did then provide in the sending of this fire from heaven, in a way it's an anticipation of what he's going to do on a much bigger scale at the very end of time itself. Because of course Elijah is not the only servant of God to have ever been misrepresented. Most of God's servants throughout history have experienced this to some degree at least. Perhaps you have. You've been considered uncommitted to the cause because you refuse to put your job or you refuse to put the sport that you do ahead of Jesus Christ in your life. Or perhaps you've been considered bigoted because of your views on sexual ethics. Or perhaps you've been considered weird because you sit in silence in your bedroom with your eyes closed doing this thing that you call prayer. And so we could go on with many other examples. And of course, these misrepresentations are trivial compared to the way that Christians in other places in the world today are misrepresented as dangerous and criminal and disloyal. And I'm saying then that there's a day coming when God is going to vindicate his people. And before all men, he will make it known, these are my servants. They're not freaks because they love Jesus Christ more than they love their own lives. They're not child abusers because they immerse their children from infancy in the teaching of Scripture. They're not threats to national security because they held underground meetings in defiance of government edicts. They are my servants whom I chose in eternity, whom I purchased with my son's blood, whom I love as the apple of my eye. That's who they are. I'm saying Yahweh sends fire on Mount Carmel to vindicate his servant, just as one day he will vindicate all his often misunderstood, often slandered servants. So that's the first reason he sends fire, to vindicate his servant. Secondly, to outdo his rival, to outdo his rival. And this then is the most obvious and the most important thing that Yahweh is doing here. These are dark days in the land of Israel. Let me just give you a flavor of how dark they are by reading to you from 1 Kings chapter 16. I'll just read verses 29 to 33. This sets the scene for the whole Elijah narrative. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel. And Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel in Samaria for 22 years. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord, more than all who were before him. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he was the first king, you remember, of Israel after Israel and Judah had separated, the one who erected those golden calves at the northern end and the southern end of the kingdom. So as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. He erected an altar for Baal in the house of Baal, which he built in Samaria. And Ahab made an Asherah. Ahab did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than all the kings of Israel who were before him. We've been studying the book of Judges, haven't we, on Sunday evenings? And the Judges period, of course, is a notorious low point in Israel's story, a period of terrible religious and moral chaos. And here we are now in the days of Ahab, and centuries have gone by since then. But it almost feels, doesn't it, from those verses I just read, like we're back in Judges territory again. Israel is in the grip of Baal worship. Yahweh presumably hasn't been completely forgotten, hence Elijah's reference in our passage to the people limping between two different opinions, verse 21. That is, between worshipping Baal on the one hand and worshipping Yahweh on the other. So Yahweh, as I say, hasn't been completely forgotten, but Baal occupies a very prominent position now in the land. He has his own temple in Samaria. He has his own special altar. And he has 450 prophets promoting his cause. That's where things are at in the days of Ahab. And thus, the issue that we talked about in our first point this morning, whether or not Elijah is Yahweh's servant, that's not unimportant. But it's definitely the secondary issue here on Mount Carmel. Yes, Elijah has that petition in verse 36, let it be known that I am your servant. But flanking that petition on both sides is a different petition, and it's this: let it be known that you are God in Israel, verse 36. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, verse 37. That's the primary issue here. Carmel isn't ultimately about Elijah and his prophetic status. Carmel is ultimately about Yahweh and his divine status. And when, therefore, Yahweh sends fire from heaven here, whatever else he may be doing, he's most certainly doing this. He's answering that repeated petition. And he's demonstrating that he, not Baal, is God. He's outdoing his Canaanite rival. I just want to pause there for a moment and mention in that connection something that emerges in verses 19 and 20 early on in the passage. Because both those verses, verses 19 and 20, refer, don't they, to the presence at Mount Carmel of all Israel, or all the people of Israel, as it's put in verse 20. Now, I don't know exactly what that means. It seems unlikely that every single person from the land was there at Mount Carmel. But presumably a lot of Israel, at least, was assembled there on this occasion. So this is an event then whose primary purpose is Yahweh outdoing his rival and showing that he is God. And I'm saying that for that event, the nation is present. Ordinary life in Israel presumably is suspended. Cows aren't milked. Wares aren't sold, business deals fall by the wayside, huge impractical journeys involving the young and the elderly are undertaken so that the nation can be there at Mount Carmel for this event. We're talking about disruption and upheaval here on a huge scale, and it's all in order to clear up this one issue: which of the rival deities in Israel is actually God? Now, is that something then that we in Newcastle in 2018 should just smile at patronisingly because we live in these more enlightened, less religiously obsessed times? Well, no, I put it to you this morning that this is still the single most important question that confronts us this morning. Who actually is God? Is chance God? And you say to me, well, no one believes that chance is God. Well, if you believe this morning that everything in this universe is the product of an entirely unguided evolutionary process that all began with an entirely unplanned Big Bang, then you believe that chance is ultimate reality. Chance is God. Or then again, are you God? And again, you say to me, well, no human being in their right mind believes that he or she is God. Well, if you believe this morning that your life has no higher purpose than you achieving your goals and being able to have I Did It My Way played at your funeral, then effectively you believe that you are ultimate reality. You are God. Or then again, is Jesus Christ God? As this worship service that you're at this morning with its hymns and its prayers to Jesus presupposes. I'm saying it remains the all-important question that is still worth any amount of disruption and upheaval. Who is God? Are you facing up to that question this morning? Are you ignoring it? Are you sweeping it under the carpet? Are you dismissing that as an ancient question of no modern interest? No, this is the most important question. Not who will win the World Cup. Not even will the summit between Trump and the North Korean leader go ahead. Who is God? Who is God? Who is God? That is the question every one of us needs to grapple with this morning. But just before I move on to my third heading, let me say something else as well. Yahweh, we've said, outdoes his rival here and proves that he is God. But that's not all. He doesn't simply outdo Baal here when it comes to the issue of reality. He also outdoes Baal here when it comes to the issue of what I'm going to call beauty. That is to say, compared to Yahweh, Baal not only emerges here as unreal, but he also emerges here as unattractive. I mean, one of the most striking features of this whole event is Elijah's mockery, isn't it? That we have there in verse 27. At noon, Elijah mocked them, saying, "Cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or he is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened." Now, a couple of things began that. First of all, we're not to think that Elijah here gets carried away and that he's acting beneath the dignity of a prophet of Yahweh. There's a crucial detail we have in verse 36 in Elijah's prayer when he says, "Let it be known that I am your servant and that I have done all these things at your word." And I think all these things means all these things. Everything that's happened at Carmel. Elijah hasn't been winging it. He hasn't been making it up as he's gone along. This is all carefully choreographed. The challenge at the outset, the mockery, the dousing of the altar with water, everything. It was in Yahweh's original commission to Elijah at the beginning of the chapter when he sends Elijah back to the land of Israel. So we're not to think here that Elijah is being questionable in what he does in mocking the prophets of Baal. And then the other thing here is that there's something we can easily miss, and it's this. The real mocker here in this passage is not actually Elijah. The real mocker is the narrator. Because, you know, the most mocking thing isn't Elijah's taunt. The most mocking thing is the narrator's description of the response to Elijah's taunt. I mean, you would have thought, wouldn't you, that these prophets of Baal, they would have responded to Elijah like this. "Hey, stop taking the mickey. Stop blaspheming our God. Of course he hasn't gone on a journey. Of course he isn't in the toilet. Don't be ridiculous. Stop saying such things about our great Baal." But that's not how they respond, is it? I mean, look carefully. Elijah tells them, doesn't he? "Cry aloud." That's how he begins, verse 27. "Cry aloud." Because he might be, Baal might be indisposed for the reasons that he then goes on to mention. Now, what do we read then at the beginning of the next verse, verse 28? "And they cried aloud." In other words, they take Elijah's suggestions completely seriously here. They say, "Yeah, good point, Elijah. Baal might be doing some of those things. Yeah, you're right, we should cry a bit louder." And so they do, and they up the ante, and they start cutting themselves as well, and they do all these things. because they take Elijah's suggestions with total seriousness. They don't see any mockery here. They don't recognize this as taunting. Yes, Elijah, you're right. That's effectively their response. In other words, they worship a God whom they believe does go on journeys, who they believe does need to relieve himself. They worship a God whom they believe is like that, just pretty much like ourselves, in other words. Just a souped-up human being. Just a human with a few additional powers and capabilities added on that we perhaps don't have. That's how they saw Baal, essentially like us, but just a bit better, a bit stronger, a bit more capable. Now, why doesn't Elijah need to spend hours crying aloud to his God? How come with one simple, short prayer, he immediately gets a response? Well, because Yahweh doesn't take naps. Psalm 121, verse 4, he doesn't slumber or sleep. And because Yahweh doesn't vacate one place in order to go to another place, he fills heaven and earth, Jeremiah 23, 24. And because Yahweh doesn't relieve himself, because he doesn't eat and drink like a dependent being does. He's the self-existent God revealed in the fire that needed no fuel, Exodus 3, verse 2. And Yahweh doesn't get tied up musing on a single all-encompassing theme so he can't think of anything else. His thoughts are more than can be told, Psalm 40, verse 5. And so I'm saying, by sending fire at all, Yahweh shows himself more real than Baal. And that's the fundamental point. But by sending fire in answer to a simple prayer, he shows himself more beautiful than Baal. He's not merely a souped-up human, a hybrid of spectacular powers on the one hand and creaturely limitations on the other. He's unlike us. He's infinitely above and beyond us. He operates in an entirely different way from us. He's a being who can be accessed immediately by any of his people from any corner of the world, irrespective of whatever else is going on, simply through a groan, through a whisper, through a humanly inaudible prayer. That's beautiful, I'm saying. Let's adore this God who is actually worthy of the title God. Baal's not worthy of the title God. Even if he were real, he wouldn't be worth worshipping. If he goes on journeys, if he gets tied up in a single thought and can't think of anything else. But Yahweh, he's not silly and embarrassing. He's not an extension of our own human foibles. He's the God whose ways are all matchless, godlike, and divine. I'm saying the sheer otherness, the sheer radical dissimilarity of the one true God to everyone and everything else is a gloriously beautiful thing. So why does he send fire from heaven? Well, to vindicate his servant, to outdo his rival, but then thirdly, to restore his people. To restore his people, because as his people witness, Yahweh, so conspicuously outdoing his rival, as they see the utter lack of any response as the prophets wail and dance, and as they then see a simple prayer attracting fire from heaven, how do the people respond? Well, in those wonderful climactic words, verse 39, Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. These people, for years, have been limping between two different opinions. For years, they've been frequenting the temple in Samaria. For years, they've been in the grip of idol worship. But now, suddenly, that's been blasted away. And they see with clarity, a clarity they haven't had for so long, that Yahweh is the living and the true God. And this is not an unforeseen consequence of what goes on. No, because again, look at Elijah's prayer in verse 37. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that this people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. This was part of what he was doing, Yahweh. In outdoing his rival, he was deliberately restoring his people from their idol worship. And in that connection, I think we need to notice something else here. Carmel is not the first time in the Elijah narrative that Yahweh has outdone Baal. I've mentioned several times this morning that the context here is a drought. There's a drought taking place in Israel. Why is there a drought? Well, Yahweh has sent it. Why has Yahweh sent a drought? Well, partly as retribution. You go back to the covenant curses at the end of Deuteronomy, and drought is mentioned in that connection. If the Israelites were to be unfaithful, this is what would happen. So in sending a drought, Yahweh is dealing in chastisement, in retribution with his people. But not, that's not all. He's also outdoing his rival in sending a drought. Because what is Baal? Well, Baal is a fertility god. Baal's supposed area of expertise is sending rain and making the crops grow. And here now Yahweh comes along and says that my word, my prophet's word, there's not going to be any rain for the next few years. And Baal can't do anything. And there is no rain. There's not a drop of it. And so I'm saying already, back at the beginning of chapter 17, Yahweh has outdone his rival. And just on that point, I think we all grasp, don't we, this morning, that according to the Bible, idolatry is not confined to worshipping actual idols and shrines and gods with names like Baal, with proper names. That Paul speaks in the New Testament in Colossians and Ephesians of covetousness as idolatry. In other words, an idol can be something like possessions, like money, like wealth, riches. We all have grasped that. But perhaps sometimes we struggle really to see any commonality then between these two different forms of idolatry. The idolatry of the ancient world in biblical times, the idolatry of many parts of our present world, on the one hand, where temples are involved and altars are involved and gods with names are involved, that form of idolatry on the other hand, and I suppose our modern Western form of idolatry, where it's things, it's stuff, it's ideas perhaps. We often struggle to see much commonality between the two, but here's one point of commonality between the two. Both types of God fail their worshippers. They let their worshippers down. Here's Baal. And you see, you've got to understand, when we say Baal was a fertility god, what we mean is there was no other reason really for worshipping Baal other than to twist his arm to send rain. I mean, you didn't have a relationship with Baal that was an end in itself. You didn't commune with Baal. You didn't enjoy just gazing upon the beauty of Baal. That wasn't what Baal was about. Baal was a means to an end. He was a fertility god, end of. And here are the Israelites then. And for 3 years, they've been bringing their sacrifices to Baal's altar. And they've been listening attentively to the 450 prophets of Baal, and they've been investing so much in Baal, and yet Baal just hasn't done his stuff, and there's not been so much as a drop of rain. Their God has failed in the very area he's supposed to be a God in. And modern Western gods fail also. And so you worship your body, and you work out at the gym several times every week, and you strut in front of the mirror every day, and you take such pride in your developing muscles, and then one day you get a diagnosis from the doctor and your God has toppled. Or you worship money and you do well in business, and you gain more and more of it, and you live for it, and it gets you up every morning. And then one day, suddenly, something goes wrong with some investment you've made, and everything disappears. And God has failed you. Jesus talks about that very thing, doesn't he, in the Sermon on the Mount. We'll come to it soon on a Sunday morning. Just a little thing like a moth. A little thing like a moth can attack your God when your God is possessions. And here then, Baal has failed the Israelites. And I'm saying there's a God who will not fail his people. Jesus Christ, if he is your God, he will not topple. No moths will make him topple. No change in the financial markets will make him topple. No diagnosis from the doctor will make him topple. His blood will not fail you. His intercession before the Heavenly Father will not fail you. His love will not fail you. Jesus Christ is the only God, ancient or modern, who does not fail those who bow before him. So I'm saying already then, Yahweh has outdone Baal in the drought. But this is the thing. How have the Israelites responded to that? Have they cried out when the drought came? Yahweh, he is God. Yahweh, he is God. We don't want Baal anymore. He's rubbish. He can't do what he's supposed to do. No. They've carried on worshipping Baal. 1 year of drought's gone by. They've carried on worshipping him. Another year of drought's gone by. They're still worshipping Baal. Another year. They're still limping between two opinions. 3 years of drought and these foolish people are still worshipping the fertility God who's not sending any fertility. And so you think, well, surely then, surely Yahweh is just going to abandon this people. He sent this exposure, this devastating exposure of Baal's impotence. Surely, and they haven't responded, and surely he's going to walk out on his people now. And you have Elijah now coming to Ahab and saying, summon the people at Mount Carmel. And as a reader for the first time, you'll think, wow, perhaps Yahweh is just going to come down in judgment upon his people at Carmel. Perhaps this is the end of the nation. This is the end of the covenant people. But no. Instead, Yahweh says, well, the drought didn't work. And that didn't restore my hard-hearted people. I'll do something else. I'll send fire on an altar, and that'll restore them. Because he's so determined to restore his people that even their stubbornness will not deter him from doing so. It's a wonderful exhibition, this, isn't it? Of the patience, the stubborn covenant love of Yahweh. We've seen that in Judges, haven't we? And we see it here in 1 Kings 18. You think, surely he sent the drought and they've carried on worshipping the failed God. Surely Yahweh is going to lose his patience with them now. But no, he says, if it's not a drought, it'll have to be fire. And that'll bring them back to me. He must have his people back because he loves them. And they are the apple of his eye. And as I've said, in connection with Judges, understand this morning. And don't believe anyone who tells you that the God of the Bible is harsh and cold and unforgiving. The God of the Bible is the God of 1 Kings 18, who will go to such extravagant lengths to restore his erring people. So why does he send fire? To vindicate his servant, to outdo his rival, to restore his people. One last thing, to execute his judgment. To execute his judgment. I said a moment ago that when Elijah summons the nation to Carmel, if you're reading this for the first time, you have to kind of fear the worst here. Surely this is the people now going to get their comeuppance. They're going to be dealt with severely by Yahweh. He's going to judge them. And of course, that's a right instinct, because God is a just God, and he cannot tolerate sin, and he takes sin seriously. He's a pure eyes and to look upon evil, and this idolatry is very wicked and very depraved. And so we're not wrong to think in terms of judgment. And in fact, I put it to you that on Mount Carmel then, he does execute his judgment. Fire. What's one of the most basic significances of fire in the Bible? Well, from the beginning, the fiery sword that the cherubim are grasping outside of Eden, to the end, the lake of fire into which the devil is cast. Throughout the Bible, fire is associated with judgment, isn't it? I don't think it's just arbitrary that Yahweh chooses this as the way he's going to outdo his rival Baal. He could have outdone Baal in any number of ways on Mount Carmel. But now he sends fire, the symbol in Scripture of judgment. And yet, you see, as the fire comes down in verse 38, it does not come down on this idolatrous people who have been so treacherous in their dealings with Yahweh and have been so stubborn and hard-hearted and have failed to respond to the overtures of his grace in sending the drought. The fire doesn't come down on them. It comes down instead on a bull, on an altar, an altar of Yahweh. That, the narrator is at pains to say there was a broken altar there on the mountain. Elijah built that up. And the fire came down on the bull. The fire that should have come down on the idolatrous nation. God executed his judgment because he is a just God who cannot tolerate sin. But the judgment fell on a substitute instead of on the people who deserved it. Because God cannot ultimately restore his people to himself just waiving the judgment. Because that would be unjust. The judgment has to come, but it comes on Mount Carmel, on a substitute. And you don't need me then to spell out the significance of that within the biblical storyline. That like every sacrifice and every true altar throughout the Old Testament, it's all pointing forward to the ultimate sacrifice on the ultimate altar of Golgotha, where Jesus Christ, the bull, would bear the fire of God's wrath in the place of his idolatrous people who should have been judged. If you're a believer this morning, what a wonderful thing that is. You think of all the times you flirted with idols, all the times before you became a Christian that you were in the grip of loves of all kinds, of all different kinds. And all the times since you've been a Christian that you flirted with affections that have taken the place of Jesus. And you deserve that fire, but it was poured out on him. And this morning, if you've never trusted Jesus Christ as your Savior, this is why you need to do so. Because there is fire reserved for the end of the age. And that fire, that eternal, unquenchable fire, will be poured out on you unless you're sheltering in this substitute, Jesus Christ. Interesting, isn't it, that the water that Elijah gets to be poured out on the altar, it couldn't do anything to stop the fire. And yes, at one level, that's Elijah again, that's again Yahweh demonstrating that he is just this great other kind of God who has the laws of nature in his hands. But to another level, perhaps it's connected with this judgment theme. Nothing can quench the judgment of God. The only way it can be dealt with is by being diverted onto a substitute. Nothing can stop it. You can't stop it by your good works. You can't stop it by being a good person and saying at the end of time, Lord, I've done all these things, so don't pour out your judgment on me. Nothing will work. It will be as useless as the water that was poured on the sacrifice. Only if it was poured out on Jesus at Calvary are you immune from it. And so this morning, make sure you're trusting in Jesus Christ, the only answer to the fiery judgment that all of us must otherwise face. Amen.